So I'm actually, I was asked to give a review, right? On, and I'm not really working on this topic. So I presume I'm covering for someone who canceled the last moment. So if I don't succeed, then don't blame me. Blame the organizers for the poor judgment of selecting me as a speaker. But so my goal will be really to talk about sort of review what we do in cosmological simulations, not we, but the community as a whole, in trying to model the ISM. And the question is, number one, should we actually even care? Because if the goal of cosmological simulations is to model galaxy formation, maybe we shouldn't really worry about the ISM. And because if you ask theorists would say, well, stars form from gas, we don't care about what kind of phase it is, they're just gas. And those are actually three pieces of equations from three very influential papers of the last decade, right? And they all relate star formation rate to the density of the gas, right? And sometimes you call it Schmidt law, so it had nothing to do with Martin Schmidt, in fact. He never used densities. So if you ask an observer, then of course the observer says, when then, right? Since when? Because observationally we know that stars do not form from gas, right? This is a distribution of gas in nine galaxies from things that we presented earlier today, right? And this is gas, and this is star formation as traced by the AV. Right? And yes, of course, it happens in the same galaxy, but otherwise there is no relation whatsoever between the distribution of star formation and the distribution of gas. So there is, you know, little relation. So some of them happen the same, volume, some gas is much more distributed. If you think about star formation, if you just step back and think about star formation, and of course it's a very complex process, and think, do we know anything for sure about star formation? Then I think the only one we know for sure, and the stars actually do not form from gas, right? They form from star-forming gas. Right? I think no one would argue with the second statement, right? So the proposition is that if we want to understand overall galaxy formation, we do not necessarily need to model the ISM if we can identify which gas is star-forming, right? And again, my apologies to radio astronomers who like to study H1 distribution. So from a theorist point of view, maybe it's actually, you know, an extra complexity we don't need to worry about. Okay. So then, which gas is star-forming? When we look at pictures like this, we know that each of those tiny bumps is actually a new star.
It's not true, by the way.
It's not true?
It's not.
So not every one of them? No? Okay. Well, so which ones of them have stars inside there? At least some of them have, right? So you look at this picture, and the answer is very easy, right? So all gas with AV greater than 10 is star-forming. Right? So now, if you tell this to cosmologists, they become unhappy because it's not a very practical review recipe for cosmological simulations, right? And so sometimes I think that this molecular cloud tells us something about our futile attempts of modeling star formation. So it's clearly that this property of star formicity, or whatever you want to call it, right, is a function of scale. Right? So on very small scales, we can clearly identify places of star formation, but on larger scales, it becomes harder and harder, where everything is mixed up together. So from a cosmological point of view, there are two different regimes that people actually run simulations, and those two different regimes obviously will have different implications for how we model things. So if you have a spatial resolution much larger than 100 parsecs, then essentially you're not resolving the vertical height of the disk. So from a simulation point of view, galaxies are really two-dimensional. And the biggest simulation projects that probably many, if not most of you, heard about, like Snihao, Eagle, Illustrious simulations that were highly publicized all over the place, right? So they all were done in this regime, essentially doing two-dimensional galaxies, which are not vertically resolved. There's also high resolution, usually zoom simulations that go down to sub-100 parsec scales, in which case the vertical height is resolved, the galaxies are 3D, and probably the best known example of this is FIRE project, where there's also Oscar Agerts, there's different people in this room and outside, who have done a lot of work. Daniel Severina worked on this in Israel, et cetera. And again, I'm trying to give a review, but I'm not an expert reviewer, so I'm not going to list all the projects. If I don't list your favorite project, I apologize, right, for this. I'm not trying to be comprehensive just in a talk. So if we go to large scales, that there is something that's called Kenyuka-Schmidt relation. And this is the way it was plotted 8 years ago. And sometimes it's still plotted like this, but when I see it, I know I want to ask people, where have you been for 8 years? Right? This is the wrong way to plot it. Because what we learned from things, right, the main lesson from things, is that atomic hydrogen is not star-forming gas. Right? There is very little correlation, if any, between H1 and star formation rate. Maybe only in the low densities, but even that is actually a question because it may be a selection effect. So, however, with molecular gas, there is a nice and strong correlation, right? If that is not convincing, I have more examples of this. This is, again, things in other galaxies, and there is scatter, right? So it's a correlation, right? It's not a law, right? It's a relation. There is a large scatter, which changes the function of scale, but it's approximately linear, and the same true at high redshifts. The amplitude of this correlation, this time scale for this, may actually be redshift dependent. It also may be changed from galaxy to galaxy, and actually change inside one galaxy from the main disk to the center. So there are variations, there are exceptions, right? So it's not a law by any means. But overall, for the majority of star formation, there is a reasonable correlation between molecular gas and star formation on large scales. Those are scales of the order of kiloparsec, 500 parsec, right? So many hundreds of parsecs. So for the reason for that was actually explained by Mark Kramhitz and Adam Leroy and Chris McKee in 2011 was a very elegant way of presenting things. And so the star-forming gas correlates with molecular gas well on large scales because it's the same physical process, dust shielding, that makes the gas both cold and molecular. Again, molecules are not necessarily needed for making for star formation. This correlation is sometimes misinterpreted as a statement that molecules are needed for star formation. It's not true. I don't think it's ever claimed, right? But it just means a correlation. And again, rats correlate with humans, but they don't need for our existence, hopefully. And so molecular gas can be used as a tracer. Right? It's not a necessary condition, but it's a good tracer, good empirical tracer of star forming gas on large scales. And so all modern large-scale simulations, when I talk about large scales, I do mean the two-dimensional galaxies, hundreds of parsec resolution. They all include molecular gas in their star formation recipes. Right? They all do it differently and sometimes implicitly. Right? But in practice, they all have it. So in the simplest form, it's a simple density threshold. Right? And so the simulation project like Illustris, they just put the density threshold, say star formation only allowed in gas above some particular density, and I don't even call it a model for molecular hydrogen, but effectively that's what they're doing. The Eagle, for example, project has a slightly more complicated form. It depends on the pressure, which in fact becomes the first one if you take linear relation. And there are some more complicated models in which you actually model molecular fraction as a function of density, temperature, radiation field, metallicity, whatever, etc. Principle can go for a very long range. Right, and there were sets of high-resolution simulations that actually implemented this. So the reason why the simplistic models like Ego and Howe work is because the transition from fully atomic to fully molecular is actually very, very sharp. Right? This is data from FUSE. This is comb density of total comb density of neutral gas, H1 plus H2. This is a few lines of sight through disk in the halo of the Milky Way. There's also all the points from Copernicus. And you'll find that and this is log plot in which you actually go factor in 2 in log, right? So this is minus 6, this is 0. So this transition from a normal ISM, neutral atomic ISM, in which you have molecular fractions of order of 10 to the minus 5 and the minus 6, to something which is mostly or largely molecular, right, is very sharp. It's actually steeper and exponential. It's steeper than just shielding by exponential comb of dust. It's steeper than that because it's a self-shielding and shielding of dust playing together and making it sort of helping each other to make this transition extremely rapid. This is 3 orders of magnitude. And so that's the reason why the simple threshold is actually a reasonable assumption. It's not a bad thing, it's not a stupid thing to do. So the only problem with them is that those recipes are primarily calibrated at redshift 0, so for things nearby galaxies, which means that low radiation fields and metallicity around solar. Right? But this atomic to molecular transition at high redshifts and in different environments, low metallicity environments, And it's actually different because metallicity change, radiation fields change, and other things, right? So this, for example, that's the wrong form of the Kenny-Kuchmit relation. I just couldn't find, you know, a better one in the short time I had. And this is, again, things data, the cartoon plot I showed you before. And the same plot, the same relationship at high redshift, redshift 3 galaxies from Mark Rafelski and Art Wolf, one of his last efforts that Art led. And it's clearly very different because the molecular fractions in those galaxies are, you know, different at the same surface densities. And this is work from Alberta, which was also very influential for figuring out how to sort of understanding of how star formation correlates with molecular gas. This is small Magellanic cloud, so it's next door, but it's low metallicity. And this transition is very different. And these points are roughly in the same range as these points. Right? So if you just translate from log scale to Bohr's log scale. And so in small Magellanic cloud, that's also roughly happens at comb densities, which are 5 to 6 times, 5 to 10 times higher than in the Milky Way. So it's clearly a function of environment. Right? And this is also very easily understood. And there are simple models like Mark models that were shown today that explain this very easily. So as a result, when you use the simple prescriptions like thresholds, right, which do not account for environmental dependence, sometimes you make predictions from this big simulations that can be improved, let's put it this way. Right, so this is a baryonic fraction of baryons in halos of a given mass from Eagle, it's a red line, and from Illustrious, blue line. So if you take a derivative, they actually get the signs wrong. Right, they don't agree in the sign of this effect. And I don't know whether it's all explained by this threshold, but I know it's a part of the story, the fact that this project make assumptions about star formation, you make some calibration, and then they extend them to much larger, you know, sample of observation. Sometimes they fail spectacularly. Right? Obviously, it can be improved, but it will just mean that we'll have to improve to work more on the star formation recipes and feedback recipes. So if you want to go a little bit further and actually try to model molecular hydrogen formation, right, I actually think there's no reason why you should not do that, right? Because there are several models in physics and literature. They're all more or less consistent with each other. And in some limits where they disagree, it's actually not clear who is right, who is wrong. Whereas I think, again, I'm trying to make to review, but I'm not sure I follow, you know, the whole sea of literature. I think the first one was actually by Pelopessi in 2006. And there is a famous most twist model by Mark, Chris McKee, and Jason Tomlinson. This is by far probably most used. And, you know, if you want to put something in your brand new simulation, that's what I would recommend. It works like a clock. And there is also models in which I and Andrei and I were involved. There are models by the University of Washington group, and there are actually many more now. So there are several more being produced, and but they're all consistent with each other. You can pick up any of them, and you'll probably get most of the effects of its environmental dependence on molecular gas on large scales. Yes. Yes. No, rats do correlate with humans. Yes. No, I said, I don't think it's by chance. From, at least to me, what Mark said was very convincing, right? It's a very simple physics, that it's dust shielding that makes gas cold and molecular. Okay, so I buy this explanation.
I don't know, in that sense, I'm asking, but
Well, then you have to wake up because I just said that.
Yeah,
right? I just said that. So they correlate, right? Well, it does not mean that molecules are necessary for star formation, right? It's just a correlation, they're a tracer, they're not a necessary factor, but they're a good tracer, they're a good empirical tracer, right? So that's the only thing that we need. No, because we know how to model this. Physics is very simple, or relatively simple. So we know how to model this. No, I'm saying that we know how to model molecular hydrogen, and we know empirically that stars correlate with molecular hydrogen well on large scales. So why don't we just use this empirical correlation to help us know guide which gas is star forming, right? So, sure, but if you want to figure out where humans are, but you can actually look for rats, yes. So if you want to run this analogy, sure, yes. If you want to find where humans are, yes, search for rats. But if you can only see rats, that's the way you would find humans, right? So then we go beyond that. So I think this is a good sort of advance that we made in the last 10 years or whatever. Right, so now we can go beyond sort of guess phrases. So I think that the point of having different phases of guess, I wouldn't call it a solved problem, but it's largely a solved problem. When we go beyond that, then the situation becomes quite, difficult or no, sad or whatever, discouraging. Because when you start adding more pieces of physics, the results become very controversial and inconsistent. So this is one of the examples where there's two different attempts to include photoelectric heating, and one of these works by Forbes et al. Claims that photoelectric heating alone can suppress star formation dwarfs. And there is another work by Hu et al. Preparation that claim, no, that doesn't work. And so then the jury is out who is right, who is not. Just one of the examples where trying to put more physics in different simulation efforts give completely contradictory results. And so it will be some time before this is settled down. Now, if we now go to smaller scales, crossing from this 2D to 3D simulations, going to less than 100 parsecs, right, so it's likely that the way you model physics and star formation actually should be very different. Mm-hmm. If you get down to 30 parsecs, that's a scale where you actually start identifying molecular clouds, individual molecular clouds in your simulations, and not resolving them, right? It's very important to distinguish between being able to identify something and being resolved. Sometimes people confuse it. But you start identifying molecular clouds, and in this case, you actually automatically get multi-phase ISM. Just comes out of the simulations. And generically, this is a cartoon of the different ISM phases, and you can run simulation even without any serious feedback processes. You automatically get no phases. You get atomic ISM, you get cold phase, warm phase, you get hot gas. It's all come out. You even get cold dark clouds here. Right here. That's actually a numerical artifact. but at least you get phases, not just a distribution with similar temperatures and densities. You can see those phases, right? The gas is actually living in those three clumps with small things in between. So this comes out naturally, automatically from the simulations without any particular emphasis on the feedback. It doesn't matter. That doesn't depend on the feedback. Then another part that we all have to worry is cooling. And so cooling and heating rates in gas in general depend on radiation field, and we all know this, but not everyone does something about it. So a very common approximation, like a cosmological simulation, is to compute cooling and heating rates assuming cosmic background radiation. And I think it first was done by Andrei, but then there was a whole set of different efforts that still do it today, often using Claudy to calculate the cooling rates. The problem with this approach is that interstellar radiation field in the Milky Way is about 500 times higher than the cosmic background. And it's the same true for high redshift. So on high redshift, the cosmic background is higher, but by some coincidence, the radiation fields in high redshift galaxies are also higher by roughly the same factor, a factor of 100. And so the radiation field in galaxies, unless maybe go to extremely faint dwarfs, is dominated by local sources always. And so then if you use the wrong background, you may get cooling rates wrong. And so almost all of these large scale simulations, the ones that have resolution of an excess of 100 parsecs, almost all of them use this background suppressed cooling heating functions. So they actually do it wrong, technically. And even many models which go down to 10 parsec resolution use this cooling heating functions. I only know about few attempts to account for the full field dependence. It's fire and in art, I think Brant Robertson, when he was doing this, also did it correctly. Right? And this is actually not a trivial fact. This is a cartoon version, right? But it's also real cooling functions. This is a standard cooling curve that you all have seen. This is cooling and heating functions in the halo of a galaxy which has a quasar in the middle. So when the quasar shines, it actually suppresses cooling in the whole of its halo, right? So it doesn't prevent all the gas from in the halo from cooling and continuing star formation for as long as it goes on, right? So the equilibrium temperature somewhere is order of 10 to the 5. So this suppression of cooling and increasing heating by radiation field can actually be very, very strong. This is probably extreme, But the fact that the heating rates are not done correctly is actually not a trivial fact. So whether it matters is a different question, right? So they do it wrong, but it may not matter, right, if you do things wrong. So this is an example. There's also a plot from fire simulations that they varied cooling and chemistry. And I'm sorry for missing the y-axis. This is actually star formation rate in the galaxies. And there's a function of loopback time. And basically, no matter what they do with the chemistry and cooling routines, they get the same star formation rates for the galaxy. That's another plot from University of Washington group, Charles Christensen, and then find then this primordial cooling, they get this rotation curve. With metal cooling, they get this rotation curve. When you add molecular hydrogen, you get this rotation curve. So basically, depending on what kind of chemistry and cooling function they put in the code, they get very different galaxies. So, well, primordial means just hydrogen helium. H2 is a whole H2 formation with one of those models. And so, no, clearly those two are not, at least at the surface of that, not consistent. And again, I think the jury is still out whether it's important, and maybe that's important in some limits and not important in some other limits. But that's again something that we haven't sort of settled in this field on how to do it. Here is a star formation rate in the galaxy, sorry. It actually doesn't matter because it doesn't change, right? And then all the lines are the same, so who cares? And there are now attempts, rather recent developments, attempts to put cosmic rays in the simulations. And then there's a growing body of simulation efforts that try to include cosmic rays. It's mostly cosmic rays, mostly the diffusion process in different sort of types, sometimes isotropic, sometimes anisotropic diffusion. And there's a general belief in the field, if you talk to people who work on this, that cosmic rays help sort of feedback, cosmic ray feedback helps to drive galactic wind. And one of the nice features of it is that it's rather gentle. Instead of sort of blowing something in the galaxy and letting things fly, you kind of build a pressure gradient, so it's like a ramp along which no gas can be gently accelerated. And that's maybe the way to explain the fact that a large fraction of outflowing gas is actually cold. So all those questions, how do you entrap cold gas in hot, the answer maybe you don't have to. Right? So maybe the cold gas just goes by itself because of its cosmic ray pressure. Yeah, it's a very open question. I don't know whether that's true or not, but this is one of the possibilities that's being explored right now. There's also magnetic field. Now most of cosmological modern codes include MHD now. And so the dynamo processes are being studied. People model dynamo processes. So far, any attempt to model the dynamo resulted in strong resolution dependence. This is an example from one recent paper by Ryder and Amman this year. So this is magnetic field. And the energy of the field over the initial seed energy field, which was very small. And depending on the resolutions, 9 parsec to 18 parsec, the growth rate are very different. They seem to saturate at the same value. But the surprising result of this work, for example, was that the saturation is only 1% of the equipartition. Right? So what we learned from the textbook, that you have dynamo and then the dynamo saturates the equipartition, at least in these simulations, it's not the case. Right? So whether it's correct or not, again, will have to be seen in the future. But this is just the first, you see, that's all very recent effort and people start modeling this stuff. And then you can also put them together, magnetic field and cosmic rays. They actually interact in a non-trivial way. So it seems like they must be modeled together. So this is, again, another recent paper from the RIPA group. They tried to model magnetic field and cosmic rays together, and this is growth of magnetic field again as a function of time without cosmic ray diffusion. And then if you use isotropic diffusion, you get a different result. If you use anisotropic diffusion, you get even the third result. So you can see it's a pretty much the work in progress because the results change by at least an order of magnitude. So it's clearly a completely unsolved and unsettled question, but they all seem to be important effects that people are now beginning to model. And then if you look in the future, then it looks really, really ambitious from point of view of modeling ISM. So cosmological simulations finally are getting to the point when we start making ISM. At least visually, there are some simulations that make ISM sort of looks right, right? This is actually observations and this is simulations. And if you play with the color scheme, you probably can make them look even better. right? We don't know again whether statistically it's all the right mixture, but again, visually at least, it's, it looks good. There's now really complicated efforts in modeling a data transfer, so it's not included routinely in cosmological simulations, but it's getting more and more spread, right? So this is one again, of the recent efforts by Jörg Rosdahl using Gramsci's code, and actually model five different bands going through the waves from infrared, optical, UV, ionizing radiation, and this, I don't see what it is. I think it's probably helium ionizing radiation, hydrogen ionizing radiation. And doing, you know, 18 parsec resolution simulations with detailed radiative transfer and making this pictures. No, it's all no post-processing. It's all no really fully self-consistent, no folded in, and the chemistry is all dependent on the radiation field. So it's also very expensive simulations. But we are finally getting to the point where those can be done. And it's probably not a full chemistry, but it's kind of light version of chemistry. But it's still very, very impressive effort compared to what we've been doing only a few years ago. And finally, dust, the point of the discussion we had on Monday. Right. So now there are actually simulation efforts. That's one of the plots from work by Mark Wogelsberger. It's not published yet, but will be. That tries to actually model dust as a dynamical entity, so allow supernova and AGB stars to put the dust in the ISM, allow dust in the ISM to grow, and then evolve according to the hydrodynamic scheme. So using the dust as a whole, you know, new hydrodynamic field, just like density, molecular hydrogen, and atomic hydrogen in the simulations, and start producing distributions of dust in galaxies on cosmological simulations. Again, this is all very much, you know, work in progress. Right? There's all big questions whether dust grows in the ISM or not, but it's clearly moving in this direction of trying to actually model dust as a dynamical entity in the ISM. And as usual, KTP, I end up earlier. Right? There are now efforts to model H1. So this is a work from Oscar Eggert, also it's unpublished works. Yeah, I'm actually almost done. And that tries to model the distribution of H1. It's actually a power spectrum of fluctuations in H1 maps. And it just observed and simulated. And I don't know if those actually look really, really similar, but maybe if you flip the colors, it will actually look better. If you make this now black to white and white to black. But they start getting, reproducing sort of the behavior of the power spectrum, the distribution. So start getting sort of really, really fine details about the properties of the ISM and they, as they sort of correlate on large scale into galaxies. And so basically this is all that I wanted to say. So I think the record so far is mixed. So this atomic to molecular transition, I would really call it basically it's a solved problem. I think it's modeled well now and routinely. But the only reason why it's done in cosmological simulations is because it's a good trace of star formation. And so very often, you know, H2 by itself is not a subject of study, it's just used it as a tracer for star forming gas. So again, with cooling, it's often done formally incorrectly, but the jury is out whether it actually matters or not. Right? And the fact that this big simulation projects actually make realistic galaxies may mean that it's not actually important to do it very precisely. Then there are some interesting examples of when people try to include sort of physics one at a time and then they fail miserably. And so it may be that basically there is no shortcut for doing the ISM physics well. Basically, you have to put everything once and just do everything, know the physics with radiating transfer and etc. With this process right. But the field is changing rapidly, as I said. And there are now really highly sophisticated models appearing just around the corner. And I can show some of the examples. Some of those people are actually went around the corner already. And the rest of us sort of trying to follow them. So I think I will stop with this.
So a lot of questions.
I missed why the various cooling prescriptions lead to such drastically different rotation curves.
I can't explain you why. This is what simulation results, right? So I don't know what the reason is. The reason is that the different cooling leads to something different in these galaxies. I don't think there's a simple explanation.
Okay.
for that?
I know what the paper actually said.
Okay, so.
I mean, I can at least, I read the paper and I remember what they said, and it's basically that if you have an H2 regulated star formation prescription, then the star formation occurs in sort of very high density local lumps, whereas if you don't have the H2 regulated star formation, it just sort of occurs everywhere. And if the star formation is occurring everywhere, the feedback is more distributed, less effective, you get more stuff going into the center of your galaxy, you don't blow out below angular momentum stuff as well.
I had another question, but I can comment on that. It's true, exactly like this, that we did something earlier without Charlotte, without using any prescription for H2, we're just using a high-density threshold.
No, you actually did, right? So you used this threshold as a prescription for H2. It was your prescription for H2.
Implicit prescription.
Implicit, yes.
That's right. So, but that's exactly what you were saying. You don't need to model explicitly.
Well, again, I actually think you do because it's you can pick a fixed threshold, right? But that will not change as a function of local environments, where the H2 will change. And so it may be that there are some sort of second order effects that you will discover that you're doing things wrong in dwarfs or wrong in fields in galaxies where radiation field is very strong, like starburst or something. So there are actually details that may matter.
I'm just saying the first order effect, the clustering effect that Mike was talking about, that's already taken care if you use a high density.
Yes, so the threshold is a very crude approximation to atomic molecular gas.
I had another question on the Yoki Rosdahl work that you showed. And that work is, as you said, is really nice because it's the first one that includes relative transfer, stellar irradiation, and so on. But the conclusion of that work is that, after all, the main thing that determines the star formation rate is the supernova feedback. If you remove the supernova feedback, then he has over-efficient star formation rate. So the local irradiation seems to not be very important.
Sure, I don't think anyone is going to argue that the feedback is not important, right? So, and then if you only care about the star formation rate, then maybe you don't need to do this, right? But I'm talking about modeling the ISM. My task, my assignment homework was modeling the ISM, right? And this is actually important. It may be unnecessary to model galaxies and star formation as shapes of the galaxy and their colors and large-scale distribution, but it will be necessary for modeling properties of the ISM, right? So that was the message I wanted to convey, that we're actually getting to the point where our ISM models become, if not reasonable, then at least approaching realistic.
I have a question. Can you go back to your conclusions? So cooling is often done incorrectly, but the jury is still out whether it matters that much. So this refers also to the ISM, because for star formation, cooling must matter. I mean,
that's actually
stars mass of 10,000 Kelvin.
No, that actually refers to star formation. So clearly for ISM, it's important. So for star formation, it may not, because usually, if you just look at what happens in the simulations, if the gas can cool, it cools so rapidly that if your cooling time is off by even a big factor, it actually doesn't matter because it's still the shortest time on the block. Right, so what really matters in how different time scales of different processes, how they range, right? So if your cooling time is still the shortest, you can move it around, but it still becomes the shortest, so it will still dominate the time scales. So it may be that you are allowed a lot of error in your cooling rate, and you're still not affecting the global star formation significantly. But again, we don't know that, because there are examples where it's true, and there are examples where it's not true. So I think the easiest way to do is just to do it right, and then not to worry about it.
But it does matter. It's just it has a leverage, you know. It can be faster or less fast.
Well, again, there are examples where there are galaxies in which it doesn't matter for star formation rate in those galaxies, but it may matter for other things.
Do these simulations make galaxies with these enormous H1 disks which are not forming stars?
Oh, that's easy, right? You just don't make the gas molecular, that's all.
But I mean, is that naturally coming out then?
Yes. I think it's not a problem. It's a problem. I don't think it's a big problem, yeah.
I mean, as far as I know, cosmological simulations don't produce really extended H1 disks.
No, we've done so. We had the simulations where our feedback was really crappy, so we just screwed up all the centers of the galaxies completely. But if you take all the galaxies and cut out 2 kiloparsecs from the centers, throw it out, The rest just looks amazingly nice, right? Or the disk is right, or the power spectrum of H1, or the comb density distributions. You get tons of things correctly, right? You get some cosmic rays hitting those gas, right? You get a ridiculous number of things correctly.
We can't allow this to continue because they will not hear. So you need the mic. I will give you the mic in a minute, but before there is Cecilia's question.
I can just answer. I can actually show you. I have a simulation of the Milky Way galaxy that goes all the way to redshift zero. So the center is just completely screwed up. At the center, the gas goes around at 800 kilometers per second. But this goes out to 30 kiloparsecs. No? And outside a few kiloparsecs, it looks very nice. Just the whole center, which is screwed up completely, but the rest of the disk is great, and the halo is fits everything.
Okay.
So I don't think it's a problem.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So my question is about the cosmic rays. How is taken into account in this simulation?
Well, there are many different approaches, so the people use it differently. So the simplest way just includes cosmic rays as a component which diffuses.
How are they generated? It's proportional, for example, to the supernova that...
Each supernova spins a few cosmic rays, and then they allow them to diffuse with roughly diffusion coefficient. But there are more sophisticated models in which you do diffusion anisotropically, depending on your local magnetic fields. People also try to model the whole momentum, energy distribution, and the whole spectrum, and try to see how this changes. So it's getting really sophisticated at this point. And there are all kinds of effects people try to include.
Okay, so you said the diameter of the H1 disk is 30 kiloparsec, is that what you said?
No, the radius.
Huh?
It goes all the way to 30 kiloparsecs. The edge of H1 disk is around 30 kiloparsecs.
The radius is 30 kiloparsec, okay.
No, it's not a scale radius. It's the edge where it becomes fully ionized.
Okay. I see.
No, the scale radius. No, the scale radius is fine. I think.
My other question was, in for example, the fire models where the sort of effectively use a density threshold to determine what's molecular. My understanding, maybe this also a question for Mark. The fraction of molecular gas also depends on the metallicity. So if you just use a density threshold, do you...
No, I think they actually they use Mark's model, I think. I think they use Mark's model, which is again, is a great model. It's very simple and just works like a clock, right? So I try to break and I couldn't. I couldn't find the case where it breaks. So I mean, I don't know why it works, but it works amazingly well. Yeah. Well, I don't know, Mark. I think if you're dumb,
don't get to sufficient metallicities.
Again, there are many models. They're all consistent with each other. I said it's not a problem, right? So you can pick up any of them. They're all mostly consistent.
Provided that you are above a given metallicity, I would say.
Well, sure. I mean, there are corners where they fail, but then when they fail, it's not clear who is right, right? So you don't know what happens with molecular gas at metallicity 10 to the minus 2, for example. I don't know. It's time dependent, radiation fields. You start getting into details, yes, but that overall, that's already a big improvement over simple thresholds, I think.
This discussion is already very exciting, but I'd like to throw in yet another component which you mentioned, and that those are the magnetic fields.
Yes.
And if you want to stir up things, you have to mention magnetic fields.
Sure.
So you showed, this is the graph, and I was very interested to see that magnetic field grows by two orders of magnitude. So how, is this a dynamo effect?
Or yes, it grows by more than two orders of magnitude. It grows by 9. It's a energy, so. But you start with seeds, it grows by large factors, not a problem. Dynamo is very efficient in the simulations because ISM is turbulent. In fact, it's the fact that it depends on the resolution tells you that it all happens on the eddy turnaround time. And of course, the size of your smallest eddy is your resolution. And so then if you increase resolution, it gets faster and faster and faster. So there's you see, obviously, it's not converged and not converging. Can
understand. And it separates not at equipartition, but at 1% of equipartition.
Well, in this work, yes, right? So then you have to argue whether it's right or wrong. It's a different, right? So, but that's one of the interesting results that they found.
But in the current ISM?
Yeah, so they explain then why how it then becomes equipartition. It's evolution of the disk that then gives you additional, but there's just one model. Maybe the model is wrong, right? I'm just giving you examples of what's being done today, right? So this is now this year.
But wouldn't that imply if the magnetic field is so weak, in the first.
Maybe, yeah, again, I don't...
Epochs, star formation could be very different.
Yes, it could. It could be different for a variety of reasons, for example. The simplest one is that the Kennecott-Schmidt, the time scale, depletion time is 2 billion years. So, you know, time scales are important in physics. So if you do star formation at 10 billion, when the age of the universe is 10 billion years, you're actually on one side of this time scale. When you do it at redshift 6 and before, it's 1 billion year old universe, you know, on the other side of this time scale. So things may be very different. Just because of that.
Just another comment on the dynamo saturation. So a few years ago, Christoph Federath did some studies with turbulent driving in a box, looking at the level of saturation, and he found it depended quite sensitively on how you drove the turbulence.
Yes, yeah. I think they, if you look at the papers, they talk about this, and I think their results are consistent with that. It depends on the Prandtl number, etc.
Yeah.
But again, I'm not presenting this work, right? I'm just giving you an overview of what people are doing now.
Yeah.
So if you're interested, just go and read.
It means for different galaxies, you could. Well,
yeah, it's a very new field. So I think many of the results will not survive, but then some maybe. But I'm just telling you what we are, as a field, we as well as the field are doing now. And trying to model no ISM, different aspects of ISM.
Okay, so I get the chance to ask the last question to Nick. So, I mean, we have to be ready to be able to simulate, you know, very faint galaxies at high redshift. And how do you think these H2 prescription can be applied when you have a less enriched?
I don't know.
Galaxy?
When I do it, it works like as a clock, as I said. I can give you examples where now everything is reproduced. And so whether it's true or false, we'll see later. But
so you mean even if you have low metallicities, you think that you can simply continue to use it even though we know that, I mean, it has not been developed. Wait.
I think, Nick, you should qualify your statement. So not all H2 models are equal, right? So at low metallicities, what works for you as a clock is your model with drain, which actually behaves very differently at low metallicities. Right?
Well, at very low metallicities, yes. So it's
well,
it's,
very it's, low it's, is point below 0.1, it's already
yes,
quite different.
Yes.
So what works is actually not everything, but gnadin and drain, 14.
Well, I mean, the gnadin and drain works for gnadin, so I don't
a
know.
A good
what
qualification.
Kramhals and Makiyo probably work for Kramhals, so then.
Okay.
So again, the jury is still out. This will be sorted. I think JWST will be very useful for actually constraining this.
Yeah, I mean.
So I think we will learn a great deal from that.
Yeah, on that, I mean, you know, we showed that the KMT model starts to fail at sufficiently low metallicity below sort of, you know, between 1% and 10% of solar, and it has to do with not capturing the non-equilibrium nature of the chemistry.
Well, you mean we?
Well, yeah, in our paper.
Well, in this case, it actually wasn't clear which one fails.
We tested the KMT model and found that it failed at between 1% and 10% because it doesn't capture the non-equilibrium. You know, the time scales become too long.
Right.
The thing is, actually, for the star formation, though, you know, this is where it actually matters that the chemistry is only a proxy, and it's the temperature that matters because the thermal equilibrium time scale is 2 to 3 orders of magnitude shorter than the chemical equilibrium time scale. And so even if, I mean, this is the sort of the irony, you can get the right answer for completely the wrong reason. The KMT model will give you totally the wrong H2 fraction at 1% solar metallicity, but it will still correctly identify which gas is cold enough to form stars, even if it gives you the wrong chemistry.
But then
well, so when you go, I agree entirely. So this is low metallicity and may still now require a lot of work.
Sorry, just to answer to you and also to the general question whether H2 is important for star formation or not. It's true that dust does the cooling, but you have to get to the stage where the gas and dust are coupled.
No. Shielding.
But you still have to get to the situation where you have a certain. And so you're saying that you could start from 10 per centimeter cube, but you could have.
No, it's a question of scales, right? So it's all question of scales, obviously. So this H2 prescription has been shown to work well on large scales, on scales of hundreds of parsecs, where the Kennecott-Schmidt relation holds, right? Now, if you go to small scales, the scatter increases very largely, and basically Kennecott-Schmidt relation breaks down on scales of hundreds of parsecs or so. So it's all question of scale, right? So what I said about molecular-based molecular hydrogen-based star formation, it's only applicable to this high-resolution simulations, right? The resolution goes to, you know, hundreds of parsecs. In this case, you know, there's no question about resolving dust to gas coupling. No, it all happens on way, way smaller scales. Right? So it's always the large-scale behavior that matters, not what happens in detail. So if you go to small scales, it becomes much more complicated. Yeah, that's
okay,
my question.
So we have the last, very last question from Simon.
Okay, just two quick comments. I have to disagree with Mark slightly. Dust cooling is important for star formation. Most of the orders of magnitude of density you change, you're cooled by dust.
Simon, it's a question, it's a question of a scale.
This is true.
Simon, it's a question of a scale.
One more time, girls, ladies.
On 1 megapascal scale, even Bayesian physics is not important. So it's all a question of a scale.
And the other point I wanted to make is you do not need molecular cooling to get to the densities where dust takes over. We've done simulations where we disabled all the molecular chemistry. You still fine structure cooling gets.
But again, I don't think anyone ever said that you need molecules to form stars, right? You do not need rats to make a human. So.
Yes, but you'd be surprised by the number of people that assume.
I think it's a misconception, Simon. I think it's what Mordecai, who also had that. I think it's a misconception. I don't think anyone actually claimed that. Maybe it wasn't expressed clearly, but I think at least in our community, there was always a clear understanding that molecular gas is a good trace of star formation, but it's not needed for star formation. I think it was clear from the beginning. At least I had this impression.
Okay, I think this is the right moment to stop
and go
to the reception. Let's thank Nick and all the other speakers of the afternoon.